Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It's Rabbi Jeff Sachs again from Atzid and the Web Yeshiva, and we're continuing our study of Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy of prayer. We've been looking at this essay called Reflections on the Amidah, which appears in English in a volume called Worship of the Heart. We last left off with this question. The question that halachic thought labors mightily to resolve. What is the basis for permitting flesh and blood to approach his or her creator? Like, prayer seems so universal. I think I mentioned this last time. You know, prayer is universal to cultures and religions and societies throughout human history. But from a halachic perspective, we have to ask. In other words, it seems almost intuitive to say that prayer is, there almost seems to be this instinctual need to pray. You know, that you often hear people who aren't ritually observant, whether Jews or Gentiles, they're not, they're not even committed, you know, to whatever the tenets of their own faith are, but yet, to one degree or another, in one form or another, they pray. Not three times a day, not every day, but that idea of prayer, the idea that there's no atheist in the foxhole, it transcends that notion that there's no atheist in the foxhole. That there are people who pray, that there are people that feel this, whether they think of it as a form of meditation or as a form of communion, or it may not even be clear with whom they're communicating, but prayer seems to be instinctive to human culture. But the Rav posits a question in which he says, Neichateisa, how do you know? How do we know that prayer is even an option? And from a philosophical point of view, we have to ask, how does measly little flesh and blood man think that he can approach the king in his palace? So there are three fundamental ideas in Judaism on which the notion that prayer is a viable option exists. So the first is prayer is a vital necessity for the religious individual. He cannot conceal his thoughts and his feelings, his vacillations and his struggles, his yearnings and his wishes, despair and bitterness. In a word, the great wealth stored away in his religious consciousness, the entire tempest of the human spirit, cannot be stored away in the depths of his soul. And he's making a proof through observation. Prayer itself is a type of release. The cathartic nature of expressing oneself through the vehicle of prayer is just inherent, like a steam engine. Unless there's a release to vent the excess power, it'll explode. And it can't be that all of these struggles and yearnings and despair and bitterness, all of the entire emotional life that a person experiences, cannot be contained within the inner, here he says soul, he could have just as easily written the mind or the person or the being. Suppressing liturgical expression is simply impossible. Prayer is a necessity. Like the songbird must sing, the soul must pray. And again, I remind you of that teaching of Rav Kook, that in one plane, the soul, on one plane, the soul is always praying, just sometimes more at the foreground and sometimes more suppressed. The metaphor that I gave was like the pilot light in an old stove. Vital, vibrant religiosity cannot sustain itself without prayer. In some, prayer is justified because it's impossible to exist without it. In other words, the first answer is a kind of it's almost saying the question is absurd. Like, yeah, how do you know that a heartbeat is allowed? What's the halachic basis by which we allow a person to maintain a heartbeat? Well, you know, it's a silly question. It's a tautological question. Without a heartbeat, you're not alive. Without prayer, you're not religiously alive. Second, our rabbis permitted prayer not only because it's impossible for man to exist without it, but because there is historical precedent for it. And here the Rebbe resorts to an almost Talmudic type of response. In the dynamics of Talmudic argument, we have this notion of a maisa, of an action, of the behaviors of the righteous serving as proof for or the basis of religious practice, that we can look to the actions of honorable and worthy people as role models for behavior. So there's a historical precedent. The patriarchs, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moshe, the prophets, all fell before God in supplication, conversing with him as man would with a friend, laying bare before him that which was hidden in their hearts, burdening him, as it were, with their needs. The Bible is replete with examples of people praying. Avraham prays, Yitzchak prays, Yaakov prays, Moshe prays, David prays. And the prayer is biblical prayer. It's not our kind of rote, rigid, objectified, set text, which becomes a challenge in and of itself, even though it may be the only thing that allows us the ability to pray, because if we were left on our own, we might not even be able to muster the minimum. But in the biblical times, it was fluid and open and free and subjective. And they did everything. They pleaded with God. They argued with God. They made demands on God. They lived an existence in which God's presence was much more immediate. And Abraham's ability to argue with God, let's say, about Sodom, is itself a form of prayer, because it's communion with the divine. We can rely on the practice of our nation's patriarchs who approached God and strove to attach themselves to him. Verily, fear causes trembling, yet the historical fact cannot be gainsaid. Prayer is a time-honored institution in Judaism, having been revealed at the very dawn of the nation. So the first answer of what's the source of prayer is almost biological, right? It's built into the soul. The second is historical. Others have prayed, and it was deemed a worthy enterprise. Third, the temple cult, an odd translation, but Avodat Beit HaMikdash, the worship in the Beit HaMikdash, which was, again, principally the offering of sacrifices in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, is a fundamental ingredient in halakha. To bring a sacrifice is to come close to God. The Torah desired that man be intimate with God. Man must not flee from him, but rather must yearn for and move toward him. It is in these terms that the sacrificial cult in the temple must be understood. A cult, in colloquial contemporary English, cult means, you know, like you know, a group of bad people that want to brainwash you. But cult, in its earlier sense, means worship. Right. So the sacrificial cult means avodat hakorbanot, the sacrificial order, the daily sacrifices, the set sacrifices that were brought every day on behalf of the entire Jewish people, as well as the individual sacrifices that would be brought in the temple, whether animal sacrifices or grain sacrifices that were brought either as a form of retribution in place of punishment, if a sin was committed in thanksgiving of something positive, as a form of optional additional worship, a nidava, a kind of vow or a gift that someone would bring. So all of the sacrifices that were brought in the Beit HaMikdash, from time to time, says the Torah, man is to encounter God and to stand before him. The bringing of a sacrifice was also a form of encountering God, not through word, but through coming close, going to the Beit HaMikdash, to that holy special place, to that place which was dedicated to the encounter with God. He is not to fear being consumed by infinity. Right? Mortal man is not to fear being consumed by infinity and thus ceasing to be. Finite existence is not consumed by the infinite divine being. On the contrary, finite being gains strength and power and finds redemption from existential exile. In similar fashion, prayer too permits man to confront God. Right? So similar to korbanot, to sacrifice, prayer is a way for man to confront God. Thus, if bringing a sacrifice constitutes the fulfillment of a mitzvah, then prayer too is a positive commandment. So there's a parallel. There's a parallel, which is korbanot, which obviously is sanctioned in the Torah, which creates a space for man to encounter God. So too, prayer. Now, I'll come to the question in a second, but remember, there was a period of overlap when there was the sacrificial order in the Beit HaMikdash, as well as prayer, and perhaps even prayer more or less in its kind of fixed format, and we would recognize it, not just the prayers of the Avot and the biblical characters, which were much more free-form. But at a certain point, with the end of the sacrificial order in the Beit HaMikdash, prayer, which existed, was expanded to fill in that role. The notion, the kind of urban legend that once upon a time we brought sacrifices, and in the absence of sacrifices we pray, overlooks the fact that even in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, there was prayer. Even in the time of the sacrificial order, there was prayer, and there were synagogues. There were synagogues in Jerusalem at the same time that there was the Beit HaMikdash. Peter asks, are we talking about sacrifice of self in prayer, a kind of equivalence? That's not what he's saying here, although that is, of course, a theme that does exist in Judaism, that prayer in one plane, again, even though prayer existed simultaneously with animal sacrifice, but that in the absence of animal sacrifice, prayer also comes to substitute for sacrifice, the notion of unshalma parim sfateinu, that in the absence of literally the bulls, the animals that were brought in the Beit HaMikdash, our lips, we will pay lip service, not there in the pejorative sense of lip service, but that we will serve God with our lips through our prayers in the absence of being able to bring the sacrifices. That notion certainly does exist in Judaism, but that's not what he's talking about here. He's saying that what is one of the sources of prayer? One of the sources of prayer is we can look to the sacrifices, which clearly indicate the need and the precedent for creating a space, a mechanism through which we can encounter God. So obviously prayer, which is a kind of parallel channel to the sacrifices, and then later a kind of also substitute channel for sacrifices, obviously we can look to sacrifice as a precedent to sanction the existence of prayer. What about Jews who decided to live in the diaspora after the Babylonian exile finished? Dominic, I'm not sure I understand the question, how it relates to the to what we're discussing about Jews who decided to live in the diaspora. Okay, fine. Someone has an open mic. Did someone want to ask a question? Right, so in other words, prayer is parallel, on one plane, prayer is parallel to sacrifice, and on one plane, prayer is a substitute, a stand-in for sacrifice. But it's not only that, and it never was only that. Let's go on. The Talmudic dictum, and this is the Gemara in Brachot Kavav Amud Beis, 26b. The Talmud dictum that prayers were established by the patriarchs does not contradict the second statement of the sages that prayers were established corresponding to the fixed daily sacrificial order, offerings, tmid. And in fact, the Rambam quotes both opinions. Now, this is the Gemara in Brachot. Here, I gave it to you from the new Steinsaltz Korain Talmud. Alan, if you're handy, you can post the link to that, or someone else can. You can beat Alan to it. A new edition, the new translation of the Gemara into English with Rav Steinsaltz's commentary translated into English. It's a very fine volume. So the Gemara in Brachot is towards the beginning of the fourth chapter of Masechet Brachot. The Gemara says Itmar. Itmar indicates a machloket amorayim. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina amar tfilot avot tiknum. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi amar tfilot keneged tmidim tiknum. One of the most famous machlokes in all of Shas. What is the origin of prayer? So one opinion says tfilot avot tiknum, that the patriarchs instituted prayer. The other opinion says no, that the prayers correspond to the sacrifices that were once offered in the temple. And then each side marshals its proof. One proof says no, obviously the Avot instituted prayer. Avraham davened Shacharit, Mincha, Yitzchak davened Mincha, the afternoon prayer, Yaakov davened Mariv, the evening prayer. And the problem is, of course, that the Chumash doesn't actually say this. The Chumash doesn't indicate Avram Davin Shacharis, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Mariv. It says other things, and then it has to prove that those other things that they were doing are in fact actually prayer. And through a kind of typical Talmudic device of showing that that if A equals B and B equals C, A equals C, we can learn out, we can read between the lines of the black and white biblical passages and see that Avram Davin Shacharit, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Mariv. Thank you, Miriam. Miriam, post that to everyone so everyone can see it. There you go. The second opinion, that the prayers are in place of the sacrifices, even that opinion, the opinion that tefillot keneged tmidim tiknum, that the prayers are in place of the daily sacrifices, doesn't deny the fact that Avraham prayed, that Yitzchak prayed, that Yaakov prayed. It denies the fact that the prayers of the Avot become the source for our obligatory prayers. And they say, the opinion of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, that our daily prayers are instituted in place of the daily sacrifices. So just like there was a morning sacrifice, an afternoon sacrifice, and something in the evening that corresponds to Mariv, to the evening prayers, and in fact, on Shabbat, there's Musaf. There was an additional sacrifice on Shabbat and on holidays, and that's why on Shabbat and holidays we have an additional prayer, which is actually quite a very strong question on Tfilot Avot Tiknun. Where do you get Musaf from? If it's Avram Shachrit, Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Mariv, who daven Musaf? Where does Musaf come from? If the source of the prayer are the Avot, one is missing, because there's an occasional prayer, one that we daven at least once a week, sometimes more, of Musaf, the additional prayer, that has no patriarch corresponding to it. In the end, the Gemara concludes, in this kind of typical Talmudic compromise, Tfilot Avot Tiknum, Vasmachinu Rabbanan Arkabranot. That in fact, the prayers were instituted by the forefathers, but the patriarchs based them on the sacrifices. That it's a kind of shiluv, it's a kind of combination. The avot, the patriarchs, many, many years before the rabbis of the Talmud, they brought into the world the idea of prayer. When the chachamim, when the rabbis, the sages, wanted to formalize prayer, they didn't need to make it up from scratch. They knew that there were morning prayers, that there were afternoon prayers, there were evening prayers. These were the prayers of the avot. Who knows what those avot prayed and what they said and how they davened? Surely it was much different than our own davening today, our own prayer today. And when the rabbis wanted to place the davening into a more concrete framework, they took those notions of prayer which had been instituted by the forefathers and they framed it within the system of the korbanot, of the sacrifices. So the timing of the prayers and the nature of the prayers and some of the other regulations of prayer are based on the sacrifices. And some ways the prayers are based upon the more fluid prayers of the avot. The Gemara in Brachot asks a question. If somebody forgets to pray, if somebody forgets to daven, well, what do? If you miss the time frame for any one prayer, every prayer has a beginning time and has a deadline. As a matter of fact, the deadlines for prayer is the very first sugya, the very first topic in the Gemara about prayer. The beginning of the fourth chapter of Brachot, the first three chapters of Brachot deal with Shema. The fourth chapter of Brachot begins the discussion of Tefillah, of the Amidah, the actual standing prayer itself. And the very first topic that the Mishnah discusses is Tfilat HaShachar Ad Chatzot, the deadline for each of the prayers. So if you miss the deadline for a prayer, well, what do? So on one hand, we say, well, you know, prayer, it's the, go back to the first source. What's the first source of prayer? It's that kind of free expression of the soul. It must come out, like the bird must sing. It can't be silenced. So if you miss the deadline for the prayer, so then you have a chance you can do it next time. You can keep praying. Kule yome matzli vazu. All day long you should be able to go and pray. There really shouldn't be deadlines. Do you think that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were bound by deadlines? On the other hand, if the prayers are regulated by the laws of the Karbanot, Ovar Yomo Batal Karbano. The sacrifices have very rigid deadlines. And if there was a sacrifice that was meant to bring today, it can't be brought tomorrow. And a deadline is a deadline. And therefore, if the prayers are in place of the sacrifices, if you miss a prayer, you're out of luck. So this question of, you have these two origins of prayer, the liquid, fluid, subjective prayer of the patriarchs, combined together with the more rigid, time-bound, regulated, normative sacrifices, which controls? Which is the controlling source? Which dominates? And this tension that we all experience in our prayer, between being this private, intimate conversation, housed within this kind of set, rigid framework, is built into prayer itself. The Talmud itself is aware that prayer at its not its origin from the dawn of the Jewish people, but from the time that the prayer of the Avot met the sacrifices of the Beit HaMikdash and were fused together into one ritual, built in inherently is this tension. So let's go back to the Rav. The Rav says the Talmid Ketan, the prayers were established by the patriarchs, does not contradict the second statement of the sages. The prayers were established to correspond to the fixed day of the sacrificial order. Let's meet it. The presumption of the Gemara that there's a machloket, between the two sides of you is mistaken. It's not this or that. It's this and that. And in fact, the Rambam quotes both opinions because they are mutually complementary. Prayer is justified by both factors. Historical precedent, the Avot, the patriarchs, and ceremonial law of the Korbanot. For this reason, because prayer is this hybrid between two, on the surface, two dissonant sources, for this reason, Halakha insisted upon the formality and orderliness of prayer, upon a standardized structure and a set text. It prohibited anarchy and arbitrariness, the subjectiveness of which the halakha is always so suspect. It prohibited anarchy and arbitrariness in man's approach to God. Were it not that scriptural passages speak of prayer, we would have no right to pray. For that reason, one should not add to the standard format of prayer. That's a different discussion. That's a different discussion about the degree to which we can veer off the set path of what's in the in the Amida. Let's look here. So Sherry asks this question about, in other words, since on one plane the origins of prayer goes back to the Avot, and the Avot are always discussed as falling on their face in prayer, why don't we do that? That's interesting. I got a similar question from, is she online? I don't see her online. I mean, perhaps she takes the course by the archives. One of our students who must be doing the course by archives, a woman named Tamara, who's also, I mentioned, in Montana. We have now this influx of Montanese. I don't know how do you call someone from Montana. Montanese, Montanaites, Montonians, students from Montana, including Ellie Shebachaya, who's on with us now. She's a shepherd in Montana, which I think is pretty cool. So this other Montana student asked a very similar question by email earlier. So it's true that it seems from reading the biblical descriptions of the prayers of the biblical characters, their prayers looked a lot different than our own. They would fall and they would prostrate themselves and they would bow and kneel and things that actually, to most of us, seem very foreign to the Jewish prayer experience. I remember as a kid, many years ago. I've told you on different occasions that my own upbringing, was not a traditional one. I grew up in a family that had gone to America from Europe a number of generations before I was born. Quite unusual. All of my grandparents were born in America. And on one occasion, for some connection to some friend of some family, something, I found myself in a church when I was a little boy. And even though I was not terribly engaged with Jewish practice, I knew enough to know what looked Jewish and what didn't look Jewish. And I recall, even though I was there kind of just as a as an observer, I recall being very put off, I guess, by the kneeling that in the church, in this church service that I saw. I was a little boy, maybe I was 7-8 years old. It was a Catholic church. Watching, the people would go, and when they took communion, they would kneel. Not sure exactly. And they had those little, those tiny little, whatever they're called, benches that you kneel on. And I remember thinking that it was a very un-Jewish thing, this kneeling nonsense, because I knew that Jews don't kneel in prayer. It's not technically true, but it's certainly a widespread notion that, generally speaking, Jews do not kneel in prayer. Perhaps I recalled something from the Esther story, the Megillah story, about Haman not wanting to bow, and that bowing is not a Jewish thing. Perhaps that was the source of it. So the question of why don't we bow today? So the truth is, in the Beit HaMikdash, Korim u'mishtachavim, kriya v'hishtachavaya, bowing and prostrating, is either falling to your knees but remaining in an upright position, and hishtachavaya, where you fall fully, where you spread yourself out, what's called pishut yadayim v'raglayim. And if you Google it, I'm sure you can find pictures on the website of the Machon HaMikdash, the Temple Institute. They have these artist portrayals of what it looked like. They in fact would bow, and our practice is that we many people have the custom of bowing, either bowing alone or bowing down with your head to the ground, although not doing what's called pishut yadayim v'raglayim, spreading forth your hands and face to the floor. That we don't do, but on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when the Avorat Beit HaMikdash is recounted, many people do have the custom of doing this. We're careful to put down onto the floor, some towel or papers or something to prevent the prohibition of bringing your face down to the floor. Some people make a mistake. They think that those little papers they give out in shul are meant to put them under your knees so your pants don't get dirty, which is a fine thing not to do. But there is a prohibition of bringing one's face down onto a stone floor, and we're generally speaking makbid that we don't bring our face down to the floor in prayer, no matter what's on the ground, and we always put down an additional layer. So even though the Avot seem to have prayed in this kind of more ecstatic way, that's not generally speaking Jewish prayer today, partially because it was connected with the Beit HaMikdash, partially because of the Jewish anathema to bowing because of its connections to idolatry, and this was something that's connected to the temple service. So generally speaking, we pray prayer today is called the Amidah. The nickname for the prayer itself is Amidah, the standing prayer, even though we do bow, although not all the way to the ground, at different key points in the Amidah. We bow a bit at the knee and at the waist. Let me just take a look at some of these things. So some of our friends, I think it's a wonderful thing. We have a number of people in class who are, I mean, of course, I've gotten to know a few of you. I hope you won't mind. I see that some of you mentioned it here. We have a number of people in class who are gerim, who are converts to Judaism, so they bring some of their previous experiences with them in helping us understand this. And we have a number of students with us who are actually, I guess, coincidentally, a number of different people in different places in the world who are in the process of converting, and they bring their experiences to us as well. Didn't the Rav not say certain prayers, benedictions from the sitter, such as who has not been mi'a goy? I'm not sure that's the case. Crown Heights, okay. I don't know much about Crown Heights. Okay, fine. So I'm sorry, that was a bit of a sidetrack. So Sybil asks this question about not adding to the standard format of prayer. So generally speaking, the formula of prayer is what it is, and it can't be tampered with too much, even though there are places within the Amidah where there's an option to personalize. First of all together, generally speaking, one is allowed to personalize each prayer so that, and we'll get into this as we move through an analysis of the Amidah, but as you know, the 13 bakashot, the 13 categories of request in the Amidah, so if you have a particular request, you know, one of the prayers has to do with parnasah, has to do with one's livelihood, so if you have a particular request about your bank account, if you have a particular request about health, your health, or the health of those near you, you can add in a personal, you can personalize that, not in place of, but in addition to, or in the final bakasha, which is Shema Koleinu, a kind of catch-all that asks that God should hear or listen to our prayers, one can add any kind of personal requests that one has. As a matter of fact, there's an opinion in the Gemara, it's not the halakha l'maaseh, it's not the normative halakha, but there is an opinion in the Gemara that unless you personalize the prayer, you have not properly prayed. That the Amidah itself is the floor, not the ceiling. It's the framework which has to then be personalized. That's not the normative halacha. We don't pasken that way, but there is such an opinion. And in all cases, one is allowed to personalize the prayer, even though there is a position that it's better not to do that within the Amidah because sometimes it causes confusion, but nevertheless, one is allowed to personalize the prayer. That being said, we still have to more or less stick to the rigid set laid out framework as put forth in the Amidah and the Siddur at large. Outside of the specific prayers, outside of the framework of prayer, one is allowed to pray in the colloquial sense all the time. You know, those stories of the often the righteous women of old, although not only women, you know, who are constantly in conversation with God. Think of the great characters of Hasidic tales, of Yiddish literature, of you know, some of you can think of your own grandparents, maybe, or even parents, ourselves. And think of all those usually old ladies, very often old Sephardic ladies, although not necessarily. You know, you get on the bus any day in Jerusalem and you see these people sitting on the bus saying Tehillim. Now, Tehillim itself is a kind of prayer, although it's reciting a set text. But the recitation of the Psalms, the Tehillim, has supplemental prayer, of course. And even just somebody that wants to think of old Tevye, of Fiddler on the Roof fame. You know, constantly in that dialogue, that conversation, that argument with God. Well, that's also a form of prayer. not in place of going to Mincha, but in addition to going to Mincha. Okay. So yes, so Jack points out that in the Tefillah of Rifa'enu, the prayer that we ask for healing, so you can certainly add names of friends or relatives, and as a matter of fact, in many Sidurim, there's a certain formula to be used to add the specific names of people. Peter asks about why specifically vocal prayer, why Judaism doesn't go in for silent prayer, but for vocal prayer. I think actually the Rav's going to get into that, so I'll leave that to him. But it's true that Judaism's notion of prayer is vocalized prayer, not kind of inner meditation. It's actually vocalizing the words through lips, albeit in a decided undertone. Top of page 152. We know that the Torah commands the offering of two daily sacrifices corresponding to those offerings, prayers is ordained by the Asher Knesset Gedolah, members of the Great Assembly, morning and afternoon. The evening prayer was established to correspond to the consumption of limbs and fatty parts upon the altar. So this is just his restating what the Gemara says. That's Shema. My comment was referring to, again, I'll remind you, when I talk about prayer, I'm meaning specifically the Amida. The notion that prayer should be vocalized but in a decided undertone is talking about the Amida. The other things, the Shema, etc., you know, are often, depending upon the shul in which you pray, are often said out loud, sometimes together. No Jew has the right to add to these three prayers ordained by the sages of Israel. We have no license to compose new prayers. We find in the Talmud, Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, if someone was standing in prayer and remembered that he already prayed, he must cease, even in the middle of the benediction. Now, here the Rav is describing the kind of tension that I mentioned, this idea of tefillat nidava, which is always looked at with a certain amount of suspicion, possibly because the idea that somebody would volunteer to pray more beyond the set minimum was viewed as either suspicious, because after all, it's hard enough to daven properly the minimum that were required. Can you really muster the amount of kavanah, the amount of proper intent, the amount of concentration for prayers beyond that? And at worst, it was viewed as a kind of yuhara, a kind of audacious arrogance. You know, there are prayers that are set. Who do you think you are? You know, adding to that, who do you think you are that you can pick up the phone and call the boss whenever you want to? So this tension, which we've mentioned, is already played out in the sources itself. Once is enough. If one adds, it is as if he's offering two of the daily sacrifices. Kol amosif goreya. Today we're no longer competent in the articulation of elective, of voluntary prayers, of tefillot nedava. Hence we don't have such prayers. And generally speaking, this we don't do. If one wants to commune with God, to kind of pray in an informal way, please do. But the idea that somebody would pray the Amida, the set fixed text, beyond the daily required amounts, that is highly, highly, highly discouraged, even though the notion of a tefillat nidava, a voluntary prayer, a voluntary fixed prayer, does exist in halacha, it's discouraged. When a Jew prays, he must be fastidious about the entire order and form of prayer. One must begin not with supplication, but instead with acknowledgement through praise and song. Only gradually may one pass into the presentation of needs. And that's the way we do it. The Amida, as I put up on the board last time, Shevach, Bakasha, and Hoda'ah, that the requests, which make up the bulk of the weekday Amida, are sandwiched between a section, three blessings of praise, and followed by three blessings of thanksgiving. You have to begin not with supplication. You don't start off by saying, God, I need this, God, I need that, but with an acknowledgement through praise and song. Only gradually may one pass to the presentation of needs. It would be errant impudence to push forward vulgarly and to press God to respond to our petitions before we have greeted him with hymns. As the prophet did, so is the law of the Torah. And this notion of the prayerful stance before God is the way that we gear up to approach God is the next topic. Let me just, if I find myself in the middle of nowhere, asks Dominic, notes fill and sit or nothing, can I pray from the bottom of my heart, trying to recall the pattern of the Amidah, or is it better, i.e., to recite Psalms? No. In other words, reciting Psalms is very lovely, but reciting Psalms is not technically, does not fulfill the obligation of tefillah, of prayer. It's a kind of supplication. It's an optional thing. There are parts of the davening which are constituted of the tehillim of the psalms, like Psukei de Zimra, like Hallel, but that's not prayer with a capital P. This is confusing because we use prayer to refer to everything that's written in the Siddur, but tefillah, lehit palel, the daily mitzvah, what we talked about as a machloket, what the scope of that mitzvah is, but that obligation, that thrice daily obligation, is the recitation of the Amidah, at least on a rabbinic level. And if one doesn't have a sidur, and you don't know it by heart, so you're kind of stuck. That being said, Dominic, if one, remember I described something like this. There's a obligation. Let's say it looks like this. This is the set of the obligation. This is the biblical prayer. The prayer that Avram davened, the prayer that Yitzchak davened, the prayer that Yaakov davened. Superimposed on the biblical prayer is a whole superstructure of rabbinical obligations. That's this notion of standing with your feet together, possibly facing Jerusalem, possibly doing it at a set time, a set text, etc. When you pray a rabbinical prayer, you ipso facto also fulfill the biblical obligation. But if, for a technical reason, you don't know the biblical prayer, you don't know the rabbinical prayer, you don't have a sitter, you're in a place, so then you can always fulfill the biblical prayer, which is to praise God, enumerate your requests, and to thank him. Again, that's the Rambam. We looked at the Rambam. The Rambam describes the history of prayer. The Rambam describes that before the rabbis got their hands on prayer and turned it into what we know from the contemporary Siddur, you would get up. If you were able to face Jerusalem, you would face Jerusalem. You would stand. You would praise God. You would lay out your requests, and you would thank him, each person according to his own ability. So if you stand up and you say, oh, great God, I could use a little bit of money. Thank you very much. You have fulfilled the biblical obligation of prayer. It's not the most eloquent prayer in the world. It's not the most, I mean, no one's going to write that prayer down and keep it for the ages, but one has, if prayed sincerely, one has fulfilled that biblical kernel of prayer. You ask about tefillin. So this is interesting. Tefillin, of course, is worn, I mean, nowadays tefillin is worn in conjunction with prayer, but tefillin itself is, of course, an independent mitzvah. If one doesn't have tefillin, if one doesn't have access to tefillin, that should not prevent one from praying. These are separate mitzvot, which are done simultaneously. Obviously, tefillin are connected to tefillah. It's not, there's a reason that the two things are connected in the same way that Shema and Amidah are connected, even though technically speaking they're independent mitzvot. There's a discussion if one doesn't have tefillin, but we'll be getting tefillin soon, should you wait to pray with tefillin or pray without tefillin? Generally speaking, it's always better to pray shacharit with tefillin. But technically speaking, these are independent mitzvot. Let me look at this next question. Okay. Isaac asked me a private question. The Rav had certain practice. Isaac, can I refer to your question, even though you sent it to me privately? Isaac points out just that in the Rav Siddur, I mentioned to you that Korain put out last year, the year before, a Siddur with a commentary of Rabbi Soloveitchik. That commentary, the Rav didn't write a commentary on the Siddur. It's anthologized from his other writings. The Rav himself had certain practices in prayer, which, you know, were slightly different than the majority minhag amongst Ashkenazim. This has something to do with his family practices. It has something to do with the practices of Lithuanian Jewry of particular rabbinic descent. It has some things have to do with practices of the Vilna Gaon, who was very influential in certain circles, and even though it's not the majority practice, some people do this, and the Rav himself did this, but when they put together the Siddur, they put together the Siddur according to the way that most people daven. As a matter of fact, the Rav felt very strongly that people should follow their own minhagim. The fact that he had certain customs, particularly related to prayer, he did not feel that he should impose his personal customs, which he followed because of his own family custom, on his students or on anyone else, that everybody should act according to their own practice. And if he followed a certain minority custom about something, or about the wording of a prayer here, or about this practice or that practice, that was his own practice. So when they put out the Siddur, the Rav Siddur, some of the things in the Siddur are not exactly the way that he himself would have prayed, because the text of the Siddur itself is the standard text of the Siddur. The commentary on the prayers are his comments, but the text of the Siddur itself is his text of the Siddur. And it's true that he had certain different nusach here or a different practice there. 95%, 98% is exactly the same as everybody else who davens, at least nusach Ashkenaz. But because his family practice on certain things was different, so he felt it different. But he also felt that everybody should do their own thing and not feel bound by the fact that he had this kind of minority custom about this, that, or the other thing. So that explains this discrepancy in the in between the Rav's private practices on certain things versus the way they're presented in the so-called Rabbi Soloveitchik Siddur. We will continue next week from this section, the prayerful stance before God, and then hopefully we'll already start getting into the commentary on at least the first bracha. So if you can read ahead at least through page 156, if not further, that would be very good. Let me just finish looking at these chats. I guess my question, at what point can others have that difference while remaining within the realm of Judaism? Well, no, in other words, Isaac, the answer to that question is that the Rav was following, there were always, you know, variant regional customs in prayer. I mean, the major difference, of course, being between Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sfard, that the Sephardic Jews have very many differences if you look at a Siddur from Ashkenaz. But even within Ashkenazic Jewry, there were different customs about, again, we're talking about 3%. 97%, 96% of the davening is identical. But different customs about it. You say Shelo Asani Goy or Shelo Asani Nochri. Do you recite Mizmor Shir Chanukah Tabayat LeDavid? There's that chapter of Tehillim of Psalms, which is sandwiched between the prefatory section of the prayer and Pesukei DeZimra. The Rav did not recite that. The Rav did not recite that for various reasons based upon the teachings of the Vilna Gaon. Although it appears in all the Sidurim, that was not his practice, and so on and so forth. At Mincha on Shabbat, does the Amida end with the bracha Sim Shalom or Shalom Rav? So the Vilna Gaon thought that it should end with Sim Shalom, the longer bracha, the bracha which is usually recited only at Shacharit, even though in most Nusach Ashkenaz, Shalom Rav is recited as the final bracha of the Amidah at Mincha. Except the Vilna Gaon thought that whenever the Torah is read, one should say Sim Shalom. Now some of these practices actually influenced what we call here in Israel Minhag Yerushalayim. There's certain customs of prayer which the Jerusalemites of old took on. And when people come to Jerusalem, they do them, they take them. That's the way it is in the shuls. So, for example, in Chutz Laaretz, there's an additional bracha that's recited after Shema. There's a bracha after the Shema, Baruch Atah Hashem Le'olam Amen V'Amen. Which is recited right before the Kaddish leading into the Amidah. In Eretz Yisrael, this bracha is not recited. And again, that's because of the predominance of the Talmidei Hagra, the students of the Vilna Gaon, who came in Aliyah in the early 19th century, and their practices became dominant, and they influenced the customs here in Jerusalem. I mean, we talk about being the Minhag Yerushalayim, even though many of the customs of what are known as the Minhag of Jerusalem emanate from Lithuania and the students of the Vilna Gaon, although not only. There were other influences as well. So there were always regional differences and customs and things like that. Part of the nature of kibbutz galiot and Jews coming together from all different types of places and making new communities, either in America or in Israel or elsewhere, is that some of these customs get lost, and sometimes customs are kind of hodgepodge together. But that's, I guess, one of the things we deal with when the Jews move around, or even better, come back from the exile. We have to build communities together. But there are always different customs. That's not surprising. That was always the question. So if one is following one of these ancient customs, they're certainly part of Judaism. The question is the newer innovations, which halacha always looks at with a certain amount of suspicion, for reasons that should be apparent. And here I'm not even getting to the question of egalitarianism and women's role and et cetera. That's a different thing. But any type of innovation in the prayer is always looked at with a certain amount of suspicion, particularly so at times of at times when tradition feels a little bit under attack. It's naturally going to respond. The system is naturally going to respond by being even more looking upon innovation with a more jaundiced eye, when tradition feels that it's, in a stronger position. I guess it can afford to be a little more innovative, as I think we've seen in the last number of years. So I think those are some of the things. So the people have different customs. It was always the case. That was part of the whole innovation of the Hasidic movement. The Hasidim, when Hasidut started in the 18th century, they adopted various variant customs in prayer as a way of justifying their need to break away from the mainstream synagogues and to pray in their own fashion, which is why Hasidim daven was called Nusach Svard. The Hasidim themselves, of course, are Ashkenazim. They're ethnically Ashkenazim. They're culturally Ashkenazim. But they daven the Nusach Svard, the Nusach, which was not the Nusach of the Sfaradim, of the Middle Eastern Jews, but what's called Nusach Svard, which was the practice of the Ari, the great Kabbalist Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and his practices and the practices of his disciples, and that helped define and differentiate and individuate them from the larger general, what became known as the Misnagdim, the opponents to Hasidut. So this is one of the things. Yeah, I mean, Alan points out we have many historically inaccurate views of what prayer was and can be. That's certainly the case. That has something to do with that kind of the fake nostalgia that we operate under, where we assume that that Jews always thought and dressed and prayed and acted and believed just the way that we do. But that's our own conceit. And Alan's point about the advent of the printing press as a kind of unifying but also rigidifying impact was certainly true. When you think in America, when you think that now it's not the case, but in America for many, many years there was really only one English sitter in use, and if you davened in a shul of a certain type, certainly an Orthodox shul of a certain type, it was the Birnbaum sitter. And that was the English sitter of choice in most modern Orthodox synagogues, the sitter that I grew up with, but I'm sure many of you also grew up with it. Now it's hard to find one in any shuls because it was later then replaced by the art scroll and by, and then now all these other new sidurim that came out in English and Hebrew only, etc. But certainly in a modern Orthodox synagogue of a certain period where you had congregants who may not have been completely fluent in the Hebrew prayers, you need one sitter. You needed to have only one sitter. Now in my shul here in Israel, you go to shul, there's a dozen different sidurim of every different stripe, Ashkenaz and Sfard and Eidot HaMizrach, because you have people davening who daven all different types of things, which presents different technical and also halachic challenges, but everybody takes the sitter of their choice, and everybody knows what page to be on. But in those synagogues of old in the United States, this is probably true elsewhere, you need to have everybody davening from the same sitter because the rabbi had to announce what page we were on. The service continues on page 356. Please open the Birnbaum sitter to page 356, where there was that thing on the wall that held the, you know, like the baseball score, held the page numbers, and there would be a kid that would hang up the numbers. Because otherwise people wouldn't necessarily know what page they were on the sitter. And the fact that everybody had a daven from one set sitter meant that whatever the minhag or the custom or the nusach of that sitter was became the de facto nusach of the community. I don't think that's true. Miriam asked a different question. That's a halachic question of like what should you do if you're praying with a minyan that doesn't follow your personal minhag. So, generally speaking, we say that the things out loud, like the kedusha, anything you say out loud, you should say according to whatever the community is following. But the things you say to yourself, you can do privately. You can daven your own thing. Right? So Dominic says that. In England, they had their own sitter. Now they have Rabbi Sachs's sitter. Before that, there was a different synagogue, what's called the United Synagogue in England, and it had the prayers for her Royal Highness, Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II, His Royal Highness, Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, and all of the members of the royal family. In America, you had the prayer for the welfare of the government, and all these different things were in each community, each country, they had things that personalized the Siddur. we digress, but only slightly. Looking back, Jack asks, "My kehila," he later tells us in Israel, "davens nusach svard." Right, so in Israel, that's the case. In Israel, very often, you'll have a community where you have Ashkenazim and Sfaradim and everybody all davening together, and either the default is that it's nusach svard, or the default is that there is no nusach, there is no one set edition of the prayers, and whoever the shaliach tzibur, whoever the chazan, the cantor is, he sets what they're doing, and sometimes it's a hodgepodge of different things. This is not without opposition, and it's not without even some halachic challenges, although nothing of earth-shattering danger. But all right, we've gone over time, so I'll end here. We'll continue next week. Thanks for the interesting side points.